This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be asking whether there's such a thing as a good financial crash. We'll also be looking at the reality of the housing crisis. And finally, we'll be asking whether it's ever okay to hire dwarves to serve food at your party. First up, earlier this week, the Dow Jones suffered its worst fall in 6 years, triggering a sell-off around the world. In his cover piece this week, Liam Halligan says this is a good sign. But is there such thing as a good crash? Liam joins me now, along with the author and economist George Magnus. So Liam, this crash looks quite dramatic. Are you really telling us it's a good thing?
It's dramatic, of course, if you're caught up in the thick of the trading and newspaper editors have been reaching for photos of people with green screens talking about 1987. But when we had Black Friday in 1987, the Dow Jones, the main stock index of the world, basically US focused, lost a quarter of its value in a single day. We've just seen a drop where the Dow lost 4.6% of its value. Pretty chunky, but manageable when you put it in that historic context. It is the biggest ever points drop, but that's because the nominal points index has been careening upwards ever since the Lehman collapse. Since Lehman, there's only been 1 year where the Dow has produced a negative return, and it was a very small negative return. In the last 2 years, we've had a 13% dollar terms return, and then a 25% return last year, which of course the Donald is suggesting is because of his genius. But the market's long been overvalued. It's long been pumped up by printed money, frankly, share buybacks and dividend payments in some senses unjustifiable. A correction was warranted. If this is the first of a series of small corrections with gravity prevailing, then that is a good thing.
George, do you agree that a correction was warranted?
Oh, I think unquestionably Liam's correct that it was overdue and actually quite normal, actually, for markets that actually go up in straight lines. I mean, you actually want them to come down, actually, to let a little bit of air out of the bubble in order for the things that really drive stock price values to assert themselves, which is the health of the economy and health of corporate earnings and so on and so forth. So it was kind of a good thing. It's what happens in markets, and we shouldn't kind of think that this is some sort of cataclysm at all. But if you look a little bit deeper, there are some kind of things that we do need to worry about, I think.
And what would you say those are?
So in my view, the sell-off that actually was most marked last Friday and on Monday of this week, it started a little bit before that. And I think the reason was, or is actually underneath, that markets are becoming very anxious about what's happening to bond yields, which is the interest rate on fixed income instruments, US government bonds. And the reason that this market is turning from a trading market into a trending market is, I think, because of the somewhat reckless behavior of the American government in passing unnecessary fiscal stimulus, unfunded fiscal stimulus at this time.
George, you just referred there to Trump's tax cuts, but it's fair to say that the US is also seeing the best economic growth for some time. So do you think the crash is a sign of strength rather than weakness?
Normally, we do unfunded tax cuts. In other words, the government borrows to fund either tax cuts or spending increases when the economy is weak. When President Reagan did this very controversial tax cutting program in the 1980s, the American economy was in a deep recession. Obviously, the American economy is anywhere but in a recession at the moment. Actually, it finished the year in a reasonably good shape. It looks like it's going to grow at a 3-4% rate during 2018. So this is the last time. I'm not saying that we shouldn't, or the Americans shouldn't, have tax reform. It's long overdue, especially for companies. But unfunded tax cuts in the way which this tax bill has gone through the Congress, I think, is something that the Americans will rue in due course.
Liam, the other point you make in your piece was that the crash was sparked by improvements to wages. Do you think the market's almost afraid of American workers starting to be paid what they're due?
Sure. This massive rise in stock markets since Lehman and all those double-digit annual returns that we've seen in 5 of the 10 years, we've had double-digit annual dollar terms returns by the Dow, have all rested on a core assumption that US inflation would stay benign and under control. So that means the Fed could continue to keep rates very close to rock bottom, and the implications for bond yields that George Magnus has talked about. But suddenly there was survey data last Friday when this crash was sparked, suggesting that US wage growth was almost 3% year on year during the year to January, which is much higher than expectations. So yes, Janet Yellen's done a great job. She leaves the Fed now. She's handed over to a Trump appointee, Jerome Powell, who we must now call Jay Powell, apparently, sort of restyling himself. She has implemented 5 interest rate rises delicately with good communication. The market hasn't crashed. I personally think, George may disagree, she's been the best central banker in the US since Paul Volcker. She's certainly shown a lot of courage. But the market's spooked. It's almost as if good news is bad news in the weird Alice in Wonderland environment we've been in, when so much market largesse has been based on central bank printing of virtual money. If there is US inflation, if Powell, following Yellen, does now have to increase interest rates faster and further than the markets were expecting, then you may get some umbrage. Equities will become less attractive, borrowing costs generally will go up quicker than expected, and even though the US economy is going gangbusters, that will hurt the markets given that they're now long overvalued.
I think Liam's point about the inflation in America, or the inflation fears in America, is a good one, but it's actually also quite nuanced, because actually a little bit of inflation should be quite good for the stock market, right? Because it means the nominal world is kind of expanding. And I think there was a little bit of exaggeration about those wage figures, because for production and what they call non-supervisory workers, actually there was very little change in underlying wages. This was really about higher paid workers and managers. So I'm inclined to dismiss that. I realize it was a proximate reason for the sell-off on that Friday, but I'm inclined to dismiss that a little bit as something that we should worry about. I think the deeper concern really lies on the fiscal side. But I think it's kind of got interesting implications for the UK as well, because obviously, to some extent, the British stock market, like all other global markets, does tend to follow the United States. But we have somewhat similar circumstances here in the UK. We have very, very low rates of unemployment. Employment is at a record high in this country. We have so far seen very little movement in wages and salaries, but I think it should remind us that we should be looking out for that kind of change, possibly. And of course, our own central bank, the Bank of England, is in a not dissimilar situation to the Federal Reserve. I mean, there hasn't really been any kind of tightening of interest rate policy as the Federal Reserve has done so far. But of course, people are expecting that to happen.
We've raised once, haven't we, here in the UK? Yeah. But after Carney lowered in August 2016, after the great Brexit crash that, of course, never happened.
Liam, ever since the crash, you've been calling for rebalancing. Do you think power is now starting to shift back to the labour market?
Yeah, immediately after the crash, let's be clear, we did need some extraordinary measures. We needed to slash rates. We needed to provide emergency liquidity. The world payment system faced a meltdown. There would have been economic carnage and even civil unrest had central banks not done what they did. My contention, and it's been my contention for many years, has been that QE went from an emergency measure that was justified into a sort of prolonged lifestyle choice. It's become crack cocaine. It allows governments to borrow willy-nilly. It allows zombie banks to keep zombie companies going, and it hurts productivity. I think what we've got happening now, as George says, I agree with him on this, the fundamentals are reasserting themselves. This was a correction, and hopefully it's the first of a series of manageable corrections rather than the beginning of a deep dive, and I think it is the former, based on the fundamentals, the notion that borrowing costs may go up. Look, we're still in a world of negative real interest rates. What does that mean? It means that savers get hammered. It means that pension funds find it very hard to meet their long-term liabilities. They have to go into increasingly frothy, juiced up assets, and that can provoke a crash. We've seen interest rates rise in the States. QE isn't over. The European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan are still QEing like crazy, even though it stops in the US and here in the UK. But if we can now move to a situation where the world economy and financial markets can think about living in a world where there isn't this constant expansion of central bank balance sheets, and we can get back to positive real interest rates, you get genuine investments happening based on fundamentals, then the economy can finally shake off the last vestiges of this crash a decade ago.
I think that's broadly right, but not completely. So I think, Liam, you know, if you look back, obviously, and I don't deny that quantitative easing had unintended consequences, which certainly weren't part of the script, but we subsequently found out with hindsight that they did have consequences that we didn't plan for and weren't really desirable. That said, what would have the alternative been for keeping the expansion going for as long as it has been? The alternative would have been that governments would have been doing more, would have been more proactive. We would have had to have backed off fiscal retrenchment and budgetary tightness and so on and so forth. And of course, that would have elicited an equal and opposite kind of outcry. So it's a little bit more nuanced than to say that they outlived their welcome. Similarly, actually looking forward, of course, I do think there is a case for interest rates to gingerly return to something that we might call normal. But I think that, as you know, monetary policy is such a
blunt
weapon.
Yeah,
you know,
Friedman's
long and
variable legs.
You know the language. that, you know, I think we do need to have a more balanced approach to macroeconomic policy. It needs to be a little bit of monetary policy, but definitely fiscal policy should be there, but framed in the right way, not as the Americans, I think, have just done.
You and I sparred at the time, George, obviously in the good-natured way that we always do. And in my Telegraph columns in 2009, 2010, I did accept we need some emergency measures. But by 2011, 2012, it was absolutely obvious that this was making asset-rich people wealthier. This was warping financial markets. This was leading to massive overvaluations. This was leading to completely egregious outcomes in the housing market and so on. And think about the scale. You know, QE was sold by the Bank of England as a £50 billion programme. £500 trillion later, will we get some more? We don't know. In the States, QE was sold as a $600 billion programme. The Fed's done six times more QE than that now. The scale of the monetary experiment has been so massive, so grotesque almost. And the reason is, George, that QE has lots of very, very powerful friends. It has lots of friends in the city because it juices up share prices. It has lots of friends in ministries across the Western world because by rigging sovereign bond markets, which of course monsters pension savings, it allows governments to avoid very tough decisions that they need to make and keep borrowing, keep borrowing, keep borrowing. US government's debt has gone from $9 trillion under Obama when he came in 2009 when QE began. It's just topped $20 trillion. That would not have happened without QE.
I don't disagree with that. We probably shouldn't spend too long sort of rewriting the history.
Nerding away.
but I think for me the issue is really had QE been abandoned much earlier, say in 2011, 2012, and there had been continued fiscal retrenchment as there has been, I don't think this expansion would have survived.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
In this week's issue, Matthew Paris suggests that there is no housing shortage, and that in fact it would be easier if there was. Matthew joins me now, along with our political editor, James Forsyth. So Matthew, you start by saying in your column that Britain doesn't have a housing shortage. How can you be quite so sure?
When I say that Britain doesn't have a housing shortage, I don't mean there isn't a huge problem with housing for a lot of people. But we don't have a housing shortage in the sense that there might be a shortage of tickets for the next performance of Hamilton, the musical, that there simply aren't any because they've all been snapped up. That is not the case with houses. Houses are being built, houses are being traded, houses are being sold. The problem is the price at which houses are being sold. And the difficulty for younger people and for people on the lower income scale to afford the houses that we have.
James, do you agree that we don't have a housing shortage?
I think that across the United Kingdom as a whole, there might be enough houses. But what there aren't are enough houses in the places where people want to live. I think there's a particular problem which is most acute in London and the South, of there not being enough houses. And I think if you could build more houses there, you would go some way towards easing that pressure.
Matthew, in your piece you mentioned Ian Mulhern and you say that you're convinced by his argument. What is his argument?
Ian Mulhern is a former Treasury official, a statistician, a blogger, and works at Oxford. His argument is that we have been overestimating the rate at which the average unit of housing in Britain is falling. The way our culture, the way our society has been going over the last 50 years has tended towards smaller and smaller households, fewer people. And that means, of course, more units of accommodation. And that process had been going on quite steeply up until a few years ago, where it appears to have levelled off and we are not any longer greatly reducing the size of our households. Now, government statisticians have tended simply to look at the average over a long period and project it onwards and upwards, instead of looking at how the line has flattened off in the last few years and projecting that flattened off line onwards. Were they to do that, they would find, says Mulhern, that our average need for new homes is much more like about 170,000 a year than the 300,000 a year that the Chancellor says. And Mulhern has also found that projections for the increase in our population have exaggerated the rate at which it's likely to increase, and the latest projections are that by 2031 we will have about 1 million fewer extra people than we thought we would have. That too impacts on calculations for likely housing need.
Well, first of all, I don't think the government is ever going to hit its housing target. So I'd rather it aim for more houses. And then if it doesn't hit it, you'd still end up with somewhere in the roughly the right region. The second thing is, I totally take Matthew's point that the population might not grow as fast as expected, but it is still going to grow and grow quite substantially over the next few decades. Hopefully a growing economy will lead to more immigration and so on and so forth. And so I think we are going to need more houses, and I think we're particularly going to need more houses in the bits of a country where people want to live, where the jobs are and the economic and cultural dynamism are.
Matthew, if you don't think we need to build more houses, what do you think we need to do to stop this problem and to stop Jeremy Corbyn getting into power?
Well, where I agree entirely with James is that there are acute pinch points of housing need in Britain, and they are particularly in London and the South. And anybody who's on a modest income in London and hoping to buy a home will know that there's a huge problem with price. Whether of availability or not, I'm not so certain, and I'm not confident, not convinced, that we could build at a rate, even in London and the South East, that would significantly reduce the price of housing, both buying homes and renting homes. At best, we could only hope to be building houses at about 250,000 a year. We're building them at about 186,000 a year, I think, at the moment. The Chancellor's talking about 300,000 a year. Even that very optimistic estimate is unlikely to impact on price. So the problem for people in London and the South East is we may build more homes, but as soon as they're up for sale, they'll be expensive just like all the other ones, and there will still be a whole generation looking for somewhere to live.
Do you think it's fair to say that younger people should just resign themselves to renting?
I think they already are. Plenty of younger people that I talk to would not tell you that their biggest problem at the moment is that they can't get onto the housing ladder yet and they really, really want to, although most people do. The biggest problem for people looking for housing in London at the moment is rent, both the level of the rents and also the rental market, the agencies, the unreasonable conditions, the deposits, the neglectful landlords. We don't seem to have got our regulations right in that respect, and that's something the government could do that would help.
Look, I agree with Matthew that you need to do something about the way that the private rented sector behaves. There are obviously far too many landlords out there kind of playing fast and loose. But personally, I'd be very concerned if young people did give up on trying to own their own home, because the property-owning democracy is what has kept British politics, I think, so relatively stable and in favour of a market rules-based system. I think if Britain stops being a property-owning democracy, I think our politics will move to the left, and move to the left quite decisively at the kind of worst possible moment, when global economic conditions and Brexit make it the worst time for Britain to turn left. This is the time when Britain needs to become even more of a market-based economy than it already is.
Well, were we to be even more of a market-based economy, I think we should be looking much more favourably on renting as a means of getting a roof over your head. They rent in America much more than we do in Britain, and that hasn't stopped America being some way to the right of us. Is it sensible that we would live in a country where everybody wants to buy a home, then stay in the home, usually regardless of whether they still need as big a home as they did before, stay in the home as a sort of investment, a kind of savings vehicle, and find it quite difficult to move anywhere else because of the home that they're already in? I think this obsession with property ownership ties a little bit of a ball and chain to the feet of what should be a nimble economy and a nimble workforce.
I think Matthew is right about the ball, in that the current levels of stamp duty are so high that they obviously do penalise penalise people who want to move, and that makes it more difficult to have a mobile labour force. I also think that, you know, the government should make it easier for people who don't need, you know, retirees who don't need as big a home as they did when they had children at home, to move down the housing ladder. That is difficult. But I think the desire and the urge for home ownership is kind of natural. I think it's a kind of impulse that is kind of culturally conditioned to everybody's grown up here. I find it hard to see us getting away from that. I think that people in this country do want to own, I think, rather than rent. And I think that, I think it will be very difficult to move away from that cultural impulse. And I slightly fear the consequences if we did.
Well, that's true of my generation. And from what you say, James, it's true of your generation too. I'm not as sure as you that we may not get a generation amongst whom the idea that you find a job first and then you rent a place that's convenient for the job isn't the better way to go. But we shall see. You may be right. The culture that you describe, James, is definitely there. Whether it's immovable or not, I'm not so sure.
I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator.
And I'd like to make you aware of a brand new subscription offer we've got going for anyone who admires the great writer Steven Pinker. For just £12, you can subscribe to The Spectator for 3 months, receive a copy of Mr. Pinker's new book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism and Progress, and tickets to see him in discussion with me, Sam Leith, at a special Spectator event this February.
And finally, on to dwarves. In this week's issue of The Spectator, Polly Morgan asks whether it's ever acceptable to hire a dwarf for your party. She joins me now, along with Mary Wakefield, our commissioning editor. So, Polly, in your piece, you talk about this phenomenon of people hiring dwarves for parties. Is this something that you've witnessed yourself?
I think I've certainly been to the odd party where there's been dwarves serving food. But the thing that prompted me to actually write the article was reports of a party that I hadn't actually attended, but the girl in question, she's very beautiful, socialite, very privileged on every front, really, had hired dwarfs to serve canapes naked. And I was just really struck by the fact that they were naked, and I was just trying to understand why someone would actually want them to strip off, particularly when you think that the bodies that characterise that condition aren't necessarily funny, when you think of the complications that can come from being born that way.
Mary, have you ever been to a party with dwarves?
The weird thing about when Polly pitched this piece was I suddenly, sort of something in my brain clicked, and I thought, this is a reasonably common phenomenon. Just like Polly, I have, you know, some friends who are sort of very grand and glamorous who I happen to know have hired dwarves to serve champagne at parties. And it's something I felt, you know, uncomfortable in my brain about it at the time, but didn't bother to think about it. And then, you know, there's our colleague upstairs says, oh yes, her best friend wanted to be handcuffed to a dwarf on a hen do. And
right, hen do's too, is it?
Our colleague Danielle was saying, no, this is just wrong, but it's across the social spectrums. It's surprisingly, weirdly popular and common to rent a dwarf and put them in, as Polly says, really genuinely quite humiliating positions. In a nappy, you say in your piece.
Yeah, there's one was dressed. I mean, I thought that the party I just described, I thought that was bad enough. And then as soon as I started to research it, I saw far worse. I mean, that paled in comparison. Yeah, one was in a nappy sitting on the knee of some big fat stag. Another was handcuffed to, there was a video of a guy handcuffed to a stag at a urinal, just literally standing right behind him, probably getting splashback in his
face.
Exactly,
and that's the joke, right? You know,
yeah,
look, his head's
thousands and thousands of likes on Facebook. I couldn't see a single comment saying, hold on a minute, this isn't pleasant.
And these people who have these parties, do you think they generally consider themselves quite sort of politically correct, but for some reason have a blind spot?
I think we have a blind spot, yeah.
Sure, I'm sure Polly's socialite friend and my sort of socialite friend, they all for saving the world.
I'm sure that, yeah,
women's
absolutely.
Rights and eco stuff.
They would never have had topless women at the party,
no,
nothing
that's the
like
thing.
That. And yet they just wouldn't think twice about
this. You
wouldn't
hire a bunch of transgender people to swan around
no,
the canopies.
Quite.
People would be appalled. You'd be objectifying them. So
yeah.
Why aren't you objectifying the dwarves?
So why is it different for dwarves, do you think?
Well, the only thing I could really conclude was that it's just not very fashionable. I think maybe they haven't had a glamorous enough spokesperson, perhaps, to kind of champion it for them. Or perhaps, as I uncovered when I spoke to Warwick Davis, it's more complicated than that. And actually, an awful lot of the people working in that employment are very grateful for the jobs. Some of them that I spoke to certainly loved the work that they were getting.
That's the fascinating thing about Polly's piece, is the kind of turn in it, in that you're ready to get outraged on behalf of little people.
I was outraged, yeah.
And then you
I
think,
spoke
oh, hang
to him.
On, they have a right to decide whether they're outraged or not.
Yeah, and Warwick Davis, quite rightly, I think, was a bit wary of do-gooders like me coming along and making life harder for, obviously he's in a particularly fortunate position, but he said he's fought very hard to get to that point and has worked with lots of other people who who really depend on this work and you don't necessarily need the likes of me coming along and making things harder for him. He compares it to the Harvey Weinstein scandal and says that if we start criticising a dwarf at a stag do, where is it all going to end up? Eventually, are they going to stop hiring them in pantomimes, which apparently has begun to happen, actually, and people are getting less comfortable with going to see dwarf-led productions.
Yes, I suppose that's right. If it's fashionable, then, you know, little people as entertainers are in demand, and that's good for them. As soon as people start to think, my friends will think I'm non-PC.
Which is a problem that he encountered with, with a play that, See How They Run, a play that was touring a couple of years ago that he put on. And he said that that was one of the biggest problems, that the people who came loved it and laughed and thought it was brilliant. But he said that trying to persuade kind of middle class audiences that they weren't being politically incorrect by coming was his biggest issue.
When you spoke to him, did you get a sense that there are lots of other avenues open for work, or is it mainly entertainment that dwarves find themselves working in?
I put it to him that they were mainly working in entertainment, just because that's, I'd heard that anecdotally. I didn't really find any statistics to back that up. And he was quite cagey about that. He seemed wary of that assumption and said, well, how do you know, and how on earth do you know what we're doing for jobs? Which is a fair point. But I do feel like they are probably overly represented in those industries. But then at the same time, they're relatively easy places for them to work. I suppose there's no accessibility problems there. Certainly, he said when he started working years ago, he used to get great roles. He was in that film Willow. He's been in loads of Hollywood films. He said actually it's getting harder and harder for actors now, for dwarf actors to get roles, because there's fewer roles for them out there. So I think that's probably changing, but I don't think he thinks that's for the good, actually.
Yeah, you've made the point that people might employ children instead.
Yeah, and tall men on their knees, apparently, too.
Oh, really?
Actually, yeah, that was another. The Kudos pantomimes that he talks about that hired children, they then went on, I think, the following year to hire tall actors on their knees. And he said, isn't that offensive to be getting tall people to impersonate dwarfs when there's dwarfs who need the employment?
Endlessly in Hollywood, you see elderly people portrayed by younger actors with
prosthetics on.
It's bloody no insulting.
Actors. Yeah, white actors.
Yeah,
Polly, which side did you come down? Your piece sort of starts off looking at kind of these parties, and then you speak to some dwarves. What was your conclusion, really?
My conclusion, really, I surprised myself. I did actually do quite a U-turn. I'm not for legislation or anything like that. I don't think we should be heavy-handed about it at all. I came down more on the side of Warwick Davis by the end of it, although I have to say I still find it really tasteless, and I would never hire... It's very dependent on what you hire them to do. I think the nudity thing is a problem for me, because one of the statistics I uncovered was that they have a 1 in 4 chance. If two dwarfs have a baby, they have a 1 in 4 chance of their child dying within days of birth if they inherit the gene from both parents. And I just thought, to be laughing at a body that represents something like that is just not very funny. Mm. But at the same time, I think to hire them to perform, certainly as actors, and to turn up to a party and to serve food. As Warwick Davis actually pointed out as well, he said a lot of jobbing actors are waiters. And he said sometimes people come to his agency and will ask for dwarfs to dress in suits and serve food at a party, and he doesn't have a problem with that. So I think there's just a line that has to be drawn somewhere, I suppose, and it's kind of up to us to do that.
That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including the Spectator Books podcast, where this week Sam Leith is speaking to Stuart Kelly about his new book. And if you like the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Peter Hitchens, Michael Moorcock and Paulina Neuding. We've got a special offer too. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, and we'll throw in a coveted red Spectator notebook. To get this, just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.